Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is America getting a bum rap? While U.S. citizens are perceived in many parts of the world as geopolitically isolated, socially splintered, and individually selfish, my guest today says those perceptions could not be further from reality. John Zogby is president and CEO of the polling and market research firm Zogby International. He has worked for decades conducting surveys of Americans' attitudes and beliefs, and he says the statistics reveal an evolution of American values and character and a declining interest in material wealth. So what does this tell us about where we're headed as a society? John Zogby writes about that in his new book, The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. What a pleasure. Thank you.
What is today's American dream?
Well, it still has a lot of the elements of the traditional American dream. There's still one-third of Americans who believe that it's about material acquisition or gain in some way. You know, anything from rags to riches to a home in the suburbs or whatever. But what I've seen over the last 10 years is a slow, steady growth up to now 40%+ of those Americans who say, you know, it's more about living a genuine life, spiritual fulfillment, giving back to the community, something about leading a better life for myself. So I call it a secular spiritualism. We are a religious nation, but this has nothing to do with God. It has more to do with just self-improvement spiritually.
It's interesting to me that you have polled for so many years on so many different subjects, and then this is the subject of your very first book. What made this the thing that you just couldn't put out of your mind?
Because it's something that was unique that I have captured over the last 20 years. In fact, to be honest, I'd set out to write a different book, actually about Americans giving up on the American dream, and I discovered actually the exact opposite. But only 9-10% of my income comes from politics, and it's very visible and very high profile, and it's a whole lot of fun, needless to say. But you know, we're out there talking to consumers, and we're out there talking to people who vote every day in some way, shape, or form. And so I wanted to tell the story of the American people. And to me, that was a whole lot more fascinating than spinning off one election or the other.
One of the things you do is you group Americans according to generation. And I'm curious as to how – is that fundamentally more powerful and a better predictor of how we'll feel than socioeconomic group or gender or race?
There are a number of factors that define who we are and what we do. But age cohorts have always been something that fascinate us. You know, there are the author is Strauss and Howe that wrote about the generations several years ago and really made a splash. And I read it and I was fascinated by it. You know, and I learned over the years that there are two things that make up an age cohort. You know, one is the life cycle. So 20-somethings are always 20-somethings.
First jobs, first marriages.
Yeah, relationships, how I look and that sort of thing. And, you know, and 30-somethings and early 40-somethings are building family, settling into career, buying a house, that sort of thing. And you go down the line. But the other thing that makes an age cohort is the historical moment. So there's always a defining moment. You know, 20-somethings were 20-somethings December 6th. 1941, but they became the greatest generation the next day with Pearl Harbor. So I wanted to see that blend. You know, we were different in the 60s. I'm a baby boomer. We were different by virtue of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and so many other movements that we carried with us in some way, shape, or form now into our pre-old age. But I was particularly fascinated by this generation of 20-somethings. I see all of the typical life cycle behavior of 20-somethings, but on the other hand, a planetary sensibility that they have that no one else has ever had, and that's the sort of thing I felt I needed to probe. So it was the first global citizens I call them, that really intrigued me. And then from there, I went on to contrast them and redefine actually the other age groups around in a different sort of way.
How much does each age group or generation sort of owe to the one that came before it? Because I know we always tend to define ourselves according to how we're different from whoever's before us and whoever follows after us.
Well, you know, to be sure, we do borrow. And we are the children of or the younger siblings of a previous generation and their world, you know, and so, you know, to a remarkable degree, those Generation Xers that came after us boomers inherited our world even more than they inherited, you know, the World War II and immediate post-World War II generation's world. And today's 20-somethings, the first globals, really have inherited what we've given them. We are a generation, we boomers and older Generation Xers, who said, I want my kid to have everything I didn't have. And so these kids do. They have everything. In fact, they have everything we didn't have, plus some. But in addition to that, you know, we enabled them. Those of us who were hurt by economic trends. Very few of us ever say, oh, I want my kid to grow up and work on the assembly line. Or when I retire from this waitress job, I want my daughter to be a waitress like me. They want and they push to have their kids have more. They wanted them to be part of a global world. And they are. And of course, technology and the ability to travel cheaply and so many other things have enabled young people. So sure, they've inherited the world that we wanted them to inherit.
And you call them globals, and this youngest generation, these 20-somethings, expect to travel all over the world.
Expect.
One in four expect they'll live somewhere else in the world.
Not hope or wish. They expect. And it's remarkable. They are as likely to say, I'm a citizen of the planet Earth, as they are to say, I'm a citizen of the United States. That's just absolutely stunning. They don't care where products are made, you know. So any appeal, you know, this is my country, buy this because it's got the American flag all over it, doesn't matter. These kids have grown up on the planet Earth and not necessarily only the United States of America. They don't think that American culture is fundamentally superior to the cultures of other people. They don't see Barack Obama as an African-American candidate for president. They see him as, oh, he's one of us. What's America going to look like 15 years from now? It's going to look like Barack Obama. And they know that because their circle of friends is so much more diverse and multicultural than any other of the previous age cohorts.
I think what you write about race is so interesting in this, in that it seems that we are, you know, despite the problems that remain, we are really pushing past a lot of things that seemed like insurmountable barriers even 20 or 30 years ago. Is it possible that American racism could almost die with the generation of Americans that are today racist?
It's almost dead. It's still there, to be sure. To some degree, it's built into institutions. And I suggest that the people are doing just fine. It's institutions and leaders who are having a rough time catching up to where the people are. A post-racist United States, oh, there'll still be elements of that, to be sure, but it plays less and less of a role. Only symbolic, but there is an African-American candidate for president of the United States. The next African-American candidate for president will just be a candidate for president.
Is there reason to worry that some of these groups that have really prospered by coming together and sort of uniting against oppression will lose some of that identification they've had?
That's a very good question. And to some degree, they have to adjust to a new world, too. And so one president, if Barack Obama were to be elected, or let's just say he's nominated, progress. One candidate or one president does not translate into progress. So there's still, quote, a struggle. But by the same token, the struggle then changes. And the struggle then moves to the economic arena and is redefined in a different way, perhaps less in terms of laws that disable institutional racism and more into opening up corporations. And of course, that's simply going to happen for demographic purposes only. You know, what's America going to look like in 15 years? It's going to be majority-minority. It's also going to be beige. How many of us and our children and our children's children over the next generation are going to be mixed? That's the fastest growing demographic in the United States, even faster than Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. The blending that's taking place, this is America, and I'm just chronicling it.
John Zogby is my guest. The new book is called The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. We don't use this phrase anymore. It sounds very dated and archaic, but does that mean there is no generation gap?
Oh, there's always a generation gap, simply because of the life cycle as opposed to the historical moment. When my kids say, "Dad, oh, you don't understand," they're absolutely correct. We grew up in two completely different worlds. It's not even worth pursuing that discussion. They're so facile in things that I can't catch up with. You know, I'm all right on the computer, but I can't do what they can do. And I don't socially network. My friends are still my friends. Their friends live all over the earth. And that's just so fascinating, and that's so different than anything we've experienced. That's only one element of it. I tell a story in the book about a waitress at a local restaurant that my wife and I went to. You're smiling. I think you know the story.
Yeah.
And, I mean, basically, we, the four of us, without the waitress, were engaged in a discussion about privacy. And at the moment, what was happening was there were these YouTube photos of Miss New Jersey and Miss Nevada that somehow got out and about, and one lost her crown and the other...
Scandalous pictures,
mm-hmm. pictures, in other words. And basically, the waitress just chimed in. And she said, you know, well, what's the big hubbub about, you know? And I said, well, do you have limits? And she said, well, I'll reveal something, but I only do it... I'll reveal something scandalous, but I'll only do it among my friends and only on Halloween. And so, oh, I said, okay, well, I'm 60 years old. I'm an old man. I said to her, so only to your friends. I'm your friend today, but I'm not your friend tomorrow. Can you prevent me from sending those pictures out to everybody? And she said, no, I can't. That's a good point. I said, well, doesn't that make you stop? And she said, well, no, so many of us are doing this. Who are employers going to employ?
There's no one who hasn't been naked on
there
the internet.
No one who hasn't, and no one will not be naked on the internet. And I'm an old man. What's bad for teenage ingenues and teenage beauty queens today is just business as usual tomorrow. Is there a generation gap? Yeah, I still don't understand that one, but it's true, I suppose.
It might be a new definition of American dream.
I get
it. And just to take a moment, because I think this is really interesting, and you talked about technology and your relationship to it. You've actually written, there's all this discussion over cell phone polling as opposed to home phone polling. You think that phone polling altogether may be on the way out?
I do. Not entirely out, but you know, the telephone replaced the face-to-face interview, but we still have to do some face-to-face interviewing. But no, the bottom line is that cell phones will create a problem for us. They haven't just yet. Studies are showing by us and by Pew Research that the cell phone-only young person is no different politically from the landline accessible young person. But the problem for us is that a typical poll, Chris, is 60 questions, 80 questions. Can you imagine getting a phone call from Zogby International on your cell phone? I have a short poll, and believe me, it's not a short poll. And so we can't do that. And there are legal prohibition. So
people
bottom
might be driving. So, let me stop you right here because we need to take a quick break. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in just a minute with John Zogby. The new book is called The Way We'll Be.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly. A part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Zogby. He's president and CEO of Zogby International. His new book is called The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. That'll happen at 6 this evening. You can learn about it at dfwworld.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, you were saying that you've discovered and Pew Research has discovered that people who only have cell phones are not so politically different from those who have cell phones and landlines both.
Right. And that's now. As cell phones are proliferated, especially among young people, it's going to cause a problem for the telephone survey. And that's why we've been pioneering with the Internet political survey. And we're pleased with its progress. It's working quite well. And basically, in a nutshell, we have over a million emails that we've been collecting, a broad representative array of Americans. We take a random probability sampling of those and invite them to a secure website to take a poll. And I'm pleased with the way the results come in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Stephen in Dallas. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It's a great show as always.
Thank you.
So my question was that with the with this younger generation having a greater interest in living abroad and being more in tune with the international community, has the linguistic skills of this generation improved beyond the, you know, the traditional monolingual deficiency of the non-Hispanic American demographics?
That's a great question. The answer simply is that so far, no, it hasn't, because American travelers are enabled by the fact that there's a huge number of people, and particularly, you know, in the travel and hospitality industry and university communities and wherever, the youth hostels, that speak English. And so, you know, English is the lingua franca. That's a good NPR term, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Comes up all the time.
That works here. And so not yet, but I suspect that there's going to be an explosion in the study of Chinese and Russian and obviously then Spanish as well, simply because people are going to have to be bilingual.
I thought it was extraordinary to read that you took a poll in 2006 that found 3 out of 4 U.S. military service people are entirely comfortable with having a gay or lesbian colleague there serving with them. How different is that from previous years?
Well, it's huge. Now, I can't relate to any previous poll because I'm not sure that there was one that was done 25 or 30 years ago, but American society wasn't as comfortable back then. And certainly when one thinks of the military 25 and 30 years ago, it was not all male, but close to all male, and also all male machismo. But, you know, society has moved, and clearly it's the military is more defined these days on can you do the job or not do the job. And essentially, it's become even more diverse, and the attitudes have become more diverse.
What do you think has led to that? And are we more progressive in this country when it comes to GLBT issues than other parts of the world?
We are to most of the world, and certainly most of the world's in the southern hemisphere, eastern hemisphere. But I don't know that we're necessarily far ahead of, say, Europe, and certainly northern Europe, where there is even more diversity in many ways than there is here. But in terms of what drives the changes, demographics have driven the changes, the empowerment of a GLBT movement, which has raised issues and which has empowered individuals to, quote, come out of the closet, both celebrities and superstars. And at the same time, you know, in the military, you know, familiarity doesn't breed contempt. Familiarity encourages relationships. And essentially, if you can do the job, that's what the military is saying. If you were doing well as a partner and I didn't even know, then if I know, what's the difference? You're And so there is an increased enlightenment, which is not to say that there still is not a struggle, and which is not to say that we're home free, so to speak, on the issue. But it is to say 3 out of 4 in the military, and the numbers were credible and very clear. We worked with the University of Southern California on that one.
It seems like, John, over the past few years, we have been trained to think of ourselves as living in a very polarized country where people are on they are red or blue and never the twain shall meet. I really liked a lot of the research you had about younger people. For example, you found that most people in this global generation are pro-choice politically, but they also most of the time tell you that they think that abortion is morally wrong.
Yeah, again, they've grown up in a different world. We boomers made a mess out of the abortion issue. Instead of finding common ground, that was the number one issue that divided us into two warring cultures. And it depends on the historical event as to what movement, you know, pro-choice or pro-life has been in the ascendancy. These young people, on one hand, have grown up in a global world and have a, quote, liberal view. Liberal, really, even in the 19th century term, libertarian view of so many things. On the other hand, they also grew up in a world of partial birth or late-term abortion, which to many is repugnant and repulsive. And so they are seeking a common ground. They are transcending red and blue America and have come up with their own solution. When it comes to abortion, tell me the situation, and then I'll tell you if it's okay or it's not okay. And I think that's remarkably sophisticated.
John Zogby is my guest. His new book is called The Way Will Be. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hi, thanks. I love your theories, and I've just got to say I'm a 55-year-old native Texan born and raised in Dallas, and yet my mother was born on a farm in Oklahoma with no running water. But my kids, I married a woman born in India, raised in England. My kids are mixed race. They've got EU, European Union passports and American passports. All their friends are international. They've lived in Egypt and studied Arabic and all of that. So I just see it so clearly, this future you're talking about. But I've got a question about something I've noticed, and let's see what you think. Down in Austin, I was going to coffee houses. I'd walk in, and there'd be maybe 100 students in there, and they're all sitting together in tables, but every single one is sitting there with a laptop open. They're all on the internet, so they're sitting with their friends, but everyone in there is sort of plugged out to another place at the same time, and multitasking and talking. And so I'm just thinking, it just seems so strange to me, but I know that this is the future. And what do you think this generation, what does this mean? I mean, their brains must be being wired differently even.
Yeah, mine's wired like yours, George. And so it's taken me a bit of a while to get accustomed to it. I taught 15 years ago and worried about this very thing. You know, are we becoming atomized, desocialized, and so on? But the reality of the situation is that they have created their own networks, and their own networks do not necessarily involve the people that they're sitting next to or the people that they meet with for coffee. Their networks involve like-minded people that they're finding all over the world. So, in effect, what we've already moved so far away from the village green and the public square where people used to gather. And, you know, Robert Putnam, who talked about bowling alone, how people are isolated and atomized and, you know, don't meet at meetings and social groupings and lunches anymore. And yet what's happening is that this generation is creating its own communities. And it's just as vital a force in their lives and reveals the same kinds of social skills and intimate needs that the rest of us have used and previous generations have used to bond with people. And so not to worry about it, but it's hard for this 60-year-old and this 55-year-old to come to grips with, but they're doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Should make a quick correction about the event this evening. It's at 8 o'clock at the Temerlin Advertising Institute at SMU's Caruth Auditorium. The lecture will be free to the public, but tickets are required. You can find information about this on our website, so just check the Think page of KERA.org. Let's go back now to the phones and speak to another Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, one of my favorite quotes is by Confucius, and it goes like this. It says, a poorly governed people are proud of their rich, and a well-governed people are ashamed of their poor. Now, given that kind of being the case, and also looking at what we're seeing happen in the economic crisis right now, I wonder if the author can speculate as to whether he might foresee a shift in how future generations will view this idea of what is to be valued in life versus what is to be ashamed of. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Boy, that's a great question, and I'm going to try on that one. But, you know, what's happening out here on one hand is that people are moving forward in terms of what they value in their own lives. Even though kids are still very materialistic in many ways, they're also bringing with them a concern about global poverty and a concern about the health of the planet and a concern about health care, including their own, and whether or not they will be covered. So there will be a sense of, quote, responsibility for those who don't have. Whether or not that's government responsibility or not, the book is still open on that. But I even find a remarkable change among so-called young Christian conservatives who are still conservatives. I mean, they're anti-abortion, they're anti-gay marriage, they're pro-guns, and they're conservatives. But what they're saying, in effect, is, okay, but we don't want to be defined by that anymore. We want to talk about global poverty. They want their pastors as well as their political leaders. And this is a wonderful instance where the pastors find that they have to meet the demand, and the political leaders are disconnected because they're still in the 90s time warp, and the young Christian conservatives are saying, what about man's stewardship of God's earth? You know, this planet is going to hell in terms of the environment. We need to take care of that. We need to talk about global poverty. We need to talk about health care for us and for those who don't have health insurance. And so in many ways, this is just one of the many moving parts out there that's taking place and that we pollsters appear to be grabbing hold of.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. It leads to a question by Joyce in Dallas. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. Well, in a way, you just answered my question. It's generally a positive view that you've taken, which I agree with. But my concern is about the old type of racism being replaced by a sort of religious divisionism. Right now, from what I understand, people on the Christian right, some of them advocate declaring us officially a Christian nation. They say it's in the Constitution. And they're different. They separate themselves in some ways. They homeschool often. Mm-hmm. They go to Christian schools and sometimes ideological colleges. And if they're going to travel, they think in terms of missionary work. And the other problem is, it's not only that they're different, it's just that they're, in many cases, out to convert those who are not of their persuasion. I was just wondering if you've covered any of this in your survey. Thank you.
That's a really good question. Some of it, no. Parts of it, yes. In terms of religious attitudes and travel, you know, even the missionaries discovered, you know, when we talk about the missionaries, you know, Christian missionaries in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, that they went to foreign countries and they had to adapt. They just simply had to. Those who didn't found themselves tied onto a raft and sent down the river or martyred. Changes took place. The successful missionaries were the ones who blended in with the natives that they were trying to convert. Today, there are so many other forces and factors that bring, say, Western values or modern values to foreign countries besides religion. And among those are these first globals and obviously globalization of the world economy. So there's a lot of moving parts that are here. In terms of Christian conservatives in this country and that very narrow view, I just related a little bit earlier, as you heard and referred to, that even they are starting to change in their focus. Even they are starting to adapt. And quite frankly, even they will not be the political force that they have been, simply because what we've developed here is a new consensus in this country. Chris was asking me earlier about red versus blue. 4 years ago, we were two warring cultures that went into an election. There was no middle. Since that time, there's been a growing middle who are saying, well, you know what I really want? I want a problem solver. I want someone who can work with the opposition. I want somebody who's competent, can command the military. This growing center in the immediate will define who wins this election, but over the longer term will undefine this red map, blue map that has divided us, you know, for the last 6 or 7 years.
Are we at a place in this country where it's realistic to imagine that a really powerful, long-lasting third party could rise?
Actually, I think we're at a point where we can imagine a second party arising. There is a party of the middle, a virtual party of the center that was that is always waiting to be formed. Ross Perot did it. You know, Mike Bloomberg has done it. To some degree, it's out there. To be very honest, had it not been McCain and Obama winning the nominations, I think a Mike Bloomberg would have run in the center and might have done very well.
John Zogby is my guest. His new book is called The Way We'll Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. We'll get to more of your calls and emails in a moment. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. John Zogby is here with me in the studio. He'll be addressing the Temerlin Advertising Institute at SMU's Caruth Auditorium this evening at 8. That lecture is free and open to the public, but you have to get a ticket. So if you need information about it, go to the Think page of KERA.org and find out how to make a reservation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now and check in with Julie in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Well, good. Hearing your guest, Dr. Zogby, is wonderful. It reminds me of seeing an old magazine that caught my eye. It was, I think, produced by IBM, and it was called Think. I picked one up for my year of birth and my sister's year of birth. But my question today is, I have a daughter, 17, and she is totally of the type that he describes. She's already writing and very dedicated to the world around her, wants to make the change, wants to make a green world, very interested in psychology. And I think it's just a knee-jerk reaction that somebody such as herself, without real direction from the career world, might think of psychology. But I'm curious to know what kind of careers might there be for the sociologist, psychologist type in the New World Order, you know, project 10 years out when she's nearly 30. what might there be for somebody like that to be able to sustain a good living and then make an impact as well?
Oh, boy, you are never hurt by having a degree in humanities or social sciences. That means that you're broad, that you have a broader view, a worldview, that there's a degree of sensitivity, that you're understanding people. And that means corporations. That means the growing dynamic of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, especially global NGOs, which are exploding. I mean, when we talk about issues like poverty and issues like the environment and so on, national governments become less and less relevant, and broad multinational NGOs become the power players and the policy makers. They will put a premium on those who have this kind of background and not just simply, you know, narrow focused kinds of, with all respect, business oriented or highly specialized kinds of degrees. I'm a pollster, but I'm a historian. That's what my degree is in. And I never even had a moment to worry about that, because the skills have always been in demand, and your daughter is making a very wise choice. By getting a degree in a social science, what she is saying is, I'm open, you know, and I'm flexible, and I want to learn about people.
I know that you poll individuals, not corporations, because you can't poll an entire corporation. But I'm wondering if any of this translates, this increased desire for meaning and this declining interest in material wealth. Are corporate values changing as well?
They are. Look at all the green advertising. Look at the criticisms of a company like Walmart that turns around now and changes its processes and its products to include more green. And that's just that. Look at a company like IBM that says, we're the globally integrated enterprise. We want citizens of the world working for us. Why? Because we need people who are flexible, who want to be in Singapore, or want to be in Saigon, or want to be in Hong Kong, or want to live and work in New York. And I mean, it's just a myriad of examples. The corporations that are surviving are the ones that have very strong, what we call CSR divisions, corporate social responsibility. They know that that's both good business and also good corporate citizenship. So to be able to identify with a country's specific needs, that's how you build a customer base, but it's also how you just be good human beings. Some of the finest people that I've met are people who are secular spiritualists who work for large corporations as well as small companies, and who are saying, hey, I'm in business obviously to make money, but I'm also in business to do to do some good things out there.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because of course a cynic would say, well, these corporations see that people want sincerity, so they're going to act sincere, you know, quotes around the word act. But of course they're all made up of human beings who live in the same society that all the rest of us do.
Yeah, they still have to breathe the air. You know, they still have to get along with people. They have to send their kids to school. And so you can see the changes that are out there. I mean, the changes are just palpable. Long way to go. I mean, let me not paint the picture of
this week in particular.
Yeah, this is a bad week. But can I talk about this week for one moment?
Yeah.
This was a genuine public revolt, and it's very consistent with what I'm saying. People want problem solving. You know, they know that something has to be done. But there is such a tremendous distrust in both corporations and Wall Street and our government. This is the worst crisis in confidence that we've had in our institution since 1932. And so what the public was saying was, all right, you're presenting us a package. Don't present us a package in 6 hours and tell us to just absorb it and that our taxes are going to go up. We want to make sure that there are some safeguards here. And so while it certainly appeared to be irresponsible that the thing was voted down, on the other hand, as I've been telling groups, the president gathered together all the king's horses and all the king's men, all of the important leaders sat within that Oval Office and hammered out a final plan, and the American public rejected it because they said, we don't trust you. We want some safeguards here.
Well, the striking difference between right now and 1932 is that the outgrowth of the Great Depression was the New Deal. Mm-hmm. All these social programs were put in place. Now we still have these programs, and we've refined them over decades. But I guess we're not willing to take that step and craft them in quite the same way for corporations.
Well, that's right, because Americans now have learned to distrust government. The book is still out. The jury is still out in terms of deciding which direction to go in the economy. And there are conservatives and there are liberals, and there's no clear direction on federal involvement. And the other thing that I tell people, here it is, today's October 1st, and we're wondering, well, what's John McCain going to do and what's Barack Obama going to do? But, you know, Franklin Roosevelt did not have a New Deal October 1st, 1932. Once he got elected, all he had ever said during his campaign was, I'm not sure what we're going to do. All I know is that we have to try something. And then the New Deal was patched together, and it worked to some degree. That's what we're going to face, I think, in November and then, more importantly, January 20th. And I'm suggesting that next January into the spring will be one of those great periods of reform, as we've had in only a few years out of the last 100, because the public just absolutely demands problem solving.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. The current financial crisis we're going through really kind of pales in comparison to the cost of the entitlement programs, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, that the baby boomers are going to demand and will continue to have the voting clout. What kind of, and none, of course, none of the politicians are talking about any resolution, any deep resolution of that. So what kind of sea change is going to happen to let America address that problem?
That's a really tough one, because the essence of entitlements are a feeling of entitlement, and they're built in and ingrained in us, with this exception that beginning with younger baby boomers and then moving down the line into, you know, Generation X, I call the Nikes, and then today's first global generation, they don't believe it. And so when you talk about the financial future to these people, whether it's a formal broker or a mentor, the first thing that that younger people learn is, now let's assume you're not going to have a Social Security check, and let's assume that you're not going to have your health care covered for you, and that's why insurance companies have come up with all sorts of assisted living kinds of insurance and that sort of thing. And so in slow and steady ways, I think we're chipping away at that notion of entitlement. It's a tough nut to crack, and no politician's going to touch it, because news media cover sound bites, and an honest politician can be so dogged by a single statement that says, well, you know what, Social Security is doomed. Let's talk about alternatives. Can you imagine somebody saying that and not being hammered to death politically?
There are not a lot of famous pollsters in the country. You splashed onto the national scene and became this household word in 96 when you sort of predicted everything correctly. I'm wondering, even since that time, how you have refined your ability to read what people are thinking on a given day, and how what they're thinking a month before the election or 6 months before the election ultimately plays out on November 4th.
Chris, the least important and least interesting question that I ever ask is the one that I'm best known for, that we're all best known for. Who would you vote for if the election were held today? That's so boring. I mean, frankly, what I want to know is, what are people thinking? And when I ask them what they're thinking, I don't really want to understand whether they support House Resolution 352, yes or no, because they don't even know what that is. Anytime I talk about a policy or an issue, I try to attach each side to a value. You know, is it about fairness? Is it about justice? Is it about the right thing to do? Is it about morality? Is it, on the other hand, about something that costs too much money, something we can't afford? But you attach it to a value. And then what I do is crunch the numbers from there. And I know that when people list for me which of the statements they agree with on this issue or on this policy, that it's coming from their heart and not just simply, you know, what they want, think that I want to hear, what they think that the pollster wants to hear. And that's then how I can sense where people are at, what presses their buttons. More importantly, not simply what a majority says, because oftentimes majorities matter a whole lot less than intensities. And so you take an issue like abortion, for example. A majority can say they're pro-choice, but if a high-intensity minority, say partial birth abortion, is repugnant and we're out in the streets and we've got video and that sort of thing, that can move mountains. I need to know then what impact that has on public opinion. And so that's what I think, you know, that's what I've been working on more than anything else. Obviously, I continue to refine the sampling technique to make sure we get the right samples, that our samples politically look like the electorate.
So do people like Frank Luntz and whoever his counterpart is in the DNC, and I'm sure there is one, who basically make a living crafting language that causes people to think about things in a particular way and making, for example, family values a Republican thing and green values a Democratic thing, did they make your job harder?
No. No, I learned from them. In fact, sometimes I even try to replicate their work because I know that their polling values – as well. Only what they're trying to do is find the right language, the right strings to pull, and to be able to go back to a candidate or to an interest and say, you know, if you say it this way, you'll move people. But if you say it that way, you won't. Or maybe don't even touch this one. Not that you don't believe it, but just don't touch it. It's not a winner for you. That's very legitimate polling. I try to do some of that sometimes as an independent to try to illuminate the process and let people see that this is really what we do. We're not manipulating the public. What we're getting the vox populi. We're getting that voice and trying to get it from the heart. And in fact, I will do some campaign work myself, a very small amount. And also similar kinds of work, you know, for companies and non-governmental organizations, you know, anyone that's out there that needs to communicate better.
John Zogby is president and CEO of Zogby International. His new book is called The Way We'll Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. He'll be appearing tonight at SMU's Carruth Auditorium at 8. You need to get tickets, but they are free. You can find information on our website. John, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure it is. I went to high school with your uncle and college with your dad. That's exciting.
Small world. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.